Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the Council on Foreign Relations Religion and Foreign Policy Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. As a reminder, today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Jacques Berliner-Blau with us today to discuss secularism in the United States and abroad. Jacques Berliner-Blau is currently Associate Professor and Director of the Program for Jewish Civilization at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service. He's been studying the subject of secularism for 15 years and is the author or editor of numerous books, articles, and chapters. His most recent book, How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom, was published in 2012, and an edited volume of Secularism on the Edge, Church State Religions in the United States, France, and Israel is forthcoming. Dr. Berliner-Blau appears frequently on media outlets and holds separate doctorates in the Hebrew Bible and the sociology of religion. Jacques, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it. It would be great if you could begin by defining secularism and talk about how different countries are addressing secularism and religious freedom.
Great. Thank you so much. I want to begin by thanking the Council for Foreign Relations for inviting me today, especially Maria Kaza, Irina Faskianos, and my esteemed Georgetown colleague, Elliot Abrams. I think the best way to get at secularism is to begin by acknowledging a problem. And one of the problems we have is that secularism, as I like to say, is one of the most confused and mangled isms in the American and global political lexicon. It's used in countless different ways by journalists, politicians, policy analysts, and yes, even scholars. And the resulting cacophony has almost vitiated the concept's usefulness. Nevertheless, what I argue is that it is a crucial conceptual tool for making sense of both domestic and foreign policy issues. And what I want to do today is identify some useful parameters for thinking about an idea which is much maligned and little understood and highly complex. So before I get to a definition, I'm just going to try and give you a sense, especially in foreign policy circles, of how confused we are. Let's go back to January 8th, 2012. It is the NBC News Republican debate in Concord, New Hampshire, and former Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania is issuing a scathing denunciation of Barack Obama's, quote, secular ideology, unquote. According to Santorum, quote, this ideology goes against the traditions of our country and what works. Later in the same debate, however, in a response to a question about whether he saw the current government of Pakistan as a theocracy, Santorum responded that he was, quote, hopeful of maintaining a more secular state than is in place in Pakistan today. Now let's go back to February 10th, 2011, at a House Intelligence Committee hearing. James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, is speaking about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And he opines that the Muslim Brotherhood is not an extremist group. And he says, here's the quote, the term Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was a very heterogeneous group, largely secular, which has eschewed violence and has decried Al-Qaeda as a perversion of Islam. Well, later that day, as many of you know, his office walked it back. His director of the Office of Public Affairs for the Director of National Intelligence issued a statement. And the statement went like this. To clarify Director Clapper's point, in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood makes efforts to work through a political system that has been under Mubarak's rule, one that is largely secular in its orientation. He is well aware that the Muslim Brotherhood is not a secular organization. So there was a confusion and a correction, or I should say, right, a confusion and a correction. Finally, let me give you an anecdote. I gave a lecture at the State Department this past summer, and many of the assembled analysts in the room wondered if ours was a secular nation, if separation of church and state was in the Constitution, and I would add it's not, and if all of that meant that their ambassador could attend an iftar celebration in the countries in which they served. I'm being a bit facetious, of course, but the questions were being asked by extremely intelligent and well-read people with tremendous cross-cultural sophistication, and their concerns made it really clear to me that secularism was at once a pivotal topic in the field of foreign service activity, And at the same time, it was something that people really, really didn't understand. All right, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a definition. This comes from my book, How to Be Secular. It took me about 10 or 12 years to come up with this, and there were many failed attempts. So I'll read it a little bit slowly. Secularism is a political philosophy which, at its core, is preoccupied and often deeply suspicious of any and all relations between government and religion. It translates that preoccupation into various strategies of governance, all of which seek to balance two necessities. One, the individual citizen's need for freedom of or freedom from religion, and the state's need to maintain order. That definition we can rehash as we move through what I hope will be a very robust Q&A. All right, let's go through some basic points, and then I think we're ready to talk. Point number two, which I'd like to make, secularism develops out of Christian political philosophy. I have retraced its genealogy in a forthcoming piece for the Oxford Handbook of Secularism, and as far as I'm concerned, and I think there's a good scholarly consensus behind this, the heroes of secularism are St. Paul, St. Augustine, William of Ockham, Marsilius of Padua, Martin Luther, who is the pivot, as he often is, between modernity and pre-modernity. That's the thing that surprises people the most about secularism, that it grows out of an organic tradition of thought within Christian political philosophical circles. Might I mention in passing recent attempts to identify similar developments in Islam? I want to refer you all to a wonderful book by Abdullahi An-Naim, Harvard University Press. It's called Islam and the Secular State, where he makes a somewhat similar argument. Misconception. Secularism is not atheism, though the confusion is prevalent, especially since the advent of the new atheists over the past decade. In the Arab world, for example, this confusion has been noted again and again, where it is often assumed that secular policies are akin to state-sanctioned godlessness. To make it as easy as possible, secularism is a philosophy with many variants about how church and state ought most profitably interact. Atheism is an anti-metaphysical doctrine about the non-existence of God. The confusions with the two set in pretty early. If you're interested, I can tell you when I think they started becoming imbricated and confused, but maybe we can deal with that after. Which brings us to my fourth point. Historically, secularists, or people who are concerned about too much proximity between church and state, have been religious people. In the U.S., for example, we had the great tradition of the Baptist and the evangelical dissenters at the time of the founding. In the mid-20th century, most mainline and evangelical Protestants favored keeping government and religion far apart. Also at mid-century, religious minorities, especially Jewish Americans, spearheaded attempts to build a wall of separation. The story of legal secularism and how the Warren and Berger courts set it in place is told masterfully by Noah Feldman of Harvard University in a wonderful book called Divided by God. My larger point is that it's not an oxymoron to refer to yourself as a secular Jew, a secular Muslim, or a secular Catholic. Next point. Secularism is often assumed to be a synonym for separation of church and state. What I wish to clarify is that separation of church and state is one type of secular policy, but not the only type of secular policy. So in a forthcoming volume that I'm editing with my colleague Sarah Feinberg of Tel Aviv University and Aurora Now of American University, I identify eight other policies that are assumed to be secular. I'm just going to read them off very quickly, and I want you all to recognize that they're not quite the same thing as separation. So here we go. State neutrality vis-a-vis religion, state non-cognizance of religion, disestablishmentarianism, equal state accommodation of all religions, state control of religion, state-sponsored a-religion, state-sponsored irreligion, or state reliance on canons of science and rationality as the sole drivers of domestic and foreign policy. All of those things have been defined as secular policies. There clearly overlaps between them, but as you can tell, they're not the same thing. Point six. Secularism has fallen on some really hard times in the past half century. As the political scientist Rajiv Bhargava, one of the great students of secularism, points out, it is a beleaguered doctrine. I point in my work to a global crisis of secularism. The name of the volume I'm editing should give away the game, as it were. The name of the volume is Secularism on the Edge, Church-State Relations in the United States, France, and Israel. And we believe that secularism is in a moment of, shall we say, it's at a crossroads right now. Either it picks itself up off the floor or it ceases to exist. What accounts for secularism's woes? I would say that's very, very simple. It has to do with the rise of traditionalist religious actors over the last 30 or 40 years. This is often referred to as the religious resurgence, the religious revival, or that pleasant euphemism, religion returns to the public square. What I want to be very clear about is that a particular type of religion has returned to the public square. It's not the left-leaning United Church of Christ that is aspiring and often succeeding to abolish abortion by gaining control of state houses across America. It's not Israel's minuscule reform movement that is railing against gender-integrated units in the armed forces. Progressive Muslims in France do not rank among those calling for stringent veiling practices. Rather, it is a very particular type of traditionalist religious formation that has masterfully, expertly, and usually quite legally contested secular state policies across the globe. All right, let's start winding it down. I want to remind you that secularism's come in all shapes and flavors. They are liberal and conservative, progressive and reactionary, benign and beastly. One should also recall that secularism has many, many theoretical flaws, and there are many questions about secularism that remain unanswered. Right? One of the major flashpoints in all conflicts that we have about secularism has to do with gender. And I would never deny that secular thought has been quite saturated by patriarchy and sexism, and the next challenge for secularism as it moves forward in the 21st century is to really think more carefully about these questions than it previously has. Finally, I'm going to use the term legitimation crisis to describe what is going on vis-a-vis secularisms across the globe. In other words, it is becoming increasingly difficult for secularisms in any given country to justify why they should exist. And we can talk about that in our forthcoming conversation. Okay, when we think about secularism in foreign policy terms, let's make sure that we distinguish two sets of questions. The first is, what are the secular arrangements on the ground in the particular country that we're studying? How are the church-state relations configured? That's one set of questions. A second set of questions is, what types of policies vis-a-vis religion in other countries are in the interest of the United States or whatever country you happen to be from. So let's make sure we divide those two questions up. I'm going to close by just pointing to some flashpoints, some countries where all types of interesting questions are being asked about secularism. The first, of course, is the United States. And in the United States, we are arguing about what we've been arguing about for a very long time, public spaces, public schools, and sexual and reproductive freedoms. We're also trying to figure out if the United States is a Christian nation, a secular nation, neither or both. France has a somewhat different tradition of laïcité, and I agree with many French scholars who argue the laïc model is not the American model. In this model, religion completely controls religion. It's not separation of church and state, it's control of the church by the state. There, the flashpoints, as you know, often have to do with religious garb in public spaces. Similarly, Canada is undergoing a very roiling debate presently in the province of Quebec. I'm sure many of you know about the PQ and their Charter of Religious Values, where public servants are asked, in the name of state neutrality and principles of gender equity, to eschew ostentatious religious symbols. It's probably one of the largest current conflicts involving secularism at present. Finally, we could also point to Israel, the Jewish state, which many argue is not a secular state at all, and that has to do with something known as the status quo agreement, which we might want to discuss. And there are huge debates within contemporary Israel about the growing power of the ultra-Orthodox, their ability to serve in the armed forces, and particularly their desire not to serve in integrated units with women. Okay, I'm sorry for the kind of scattershot nature of all that, but there are a lot of issues on the floor, and I'm really, really excited to hear your questions and your comments. And with that said, Ms. Fascianos, I will hand it back to you.
Wonderful. Thank you for that comprehensive overview, and we look forward to going into more detail with the questions and comments from the group. So, Lindsay, let's open it up now. Thank you.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, press star 2. Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star 1 now. Our first question comes from Charles Stromer with the Center of Public Justice.
Well, hi. Thank you very much for being with us today. Appreciate it. You sure overwhelmed me with your introduction, but it was great. I needed to stretch my thinking a bit. So I want to talk a little bit about foreign policy and get your thoughts on this. Just sort of use some ordinary language here. It seems to me that safely negotiating the what I call the secular-religious intersection of U.S. Mideast relations is, you know, probably a chief core concern. I think everybody would agree with that these days. And I've been doing a lot of research into that and writing the last few years, especially using what I call a norm of the wisdom tradition, in which this norm directs our attention to the basic interests and concerns and goals that are shared by the human family as a whole before distinctions are made about who's religious and who's secular. And I've been trying to use that as a sort of a normative way of helping to safely negotiate this rough secular religious intersection of U.S. Mideast relations and working with some colleagues and stuff. Could you just comment on that? You know, what you think about that? Does it make any sense to you? Critical feedback, kudos, anything at all?
Well, I mean, I need a little more information. One thing I would say is it's very interesting when we try to craft an American foreign policy vis-a-vis any other country, let alone the Middle East. Let me just turn that off. Why is that? And maybe this will help us focus the conversation. I don't think in the United States we have a very clear idea regarding what we believe is the proper way that church and state should interact. So when we ask our foreign service officers and when we task the State Department with the job of articulating an American doctrine vis-a-vis how church and state should best interact in a country, we tend to be really, really quite confused. So, Mr. Stromer, I know that doesn't perfectly answer your question, but maybe that's a good way to begin. The monumentality, the massiveness of the task that stands in front of us in simply trying to understand what we as a nation believe to be true and just and important vis-a-vis our own nation, and then taking those ideas and trying to encourage other nations to follow them.
Yeah, I've been trying to sort of look outside the American way of looking and the Middle East way of looking in the sense of using this norm of the wisdom tradition. I call it the norm of human mutuality, where, you know, policymakers and analysts and et cetera and so on can come together and say, hey, you know, okay, you're secular, I'm religious, quote unquote. I don't want to argue that right now, but so what are our basic interests that lie deeper than that we can analyze this event or this issue or this situation and have some dialogue and diplomacy around? It's sort of like helps you transcend a little bit the sort of, you know, the kind of typical way of, well, I'm going to force you to become secular, I'm going to force you to become religious, and that's going to be the key to sorting this all out. And I just think that's, you know, pretty foolish and will lead to like a class, you know, fuel the class clash of civilization. So I'm trying to sort of like step outside of it and look at it, get beyond the, you know, the typical paradigms of secular and religious, and people use those to get on the same page to make their policies and try to help everybody to get along. But this norm kind of helps you, you know, set that, you know, kind of take your fingers out of the molasses a little bit and look at what we hold together just as human beings.
So let me try, within the secular tradition, to very quickly articulate two or three starting points in terms of how we should approach other nations. No coercion in religious belief. This is something that you can find in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad as much as you can find in the writings of Martin Luther. I think that's a very, very important principle, that when it comes to the field of religion, we cannot coerce. I would add the sovereignty of conscience, this great theme that Luther imparts to Roger Williams and John Locke picks up on, and Mr. Jefferson and Mr. Madison embellish and augment, the idea that conscience is sacred and sovereign, and states do not have a right to tangle with that or to mess with what people believe, what they actually do. That's a different case. So I would say a foreign policy in the wisdom tradition, in my reading, would acknowledge that there are two great goods: freedom of religion, and maybe this departs a little bit from the wisdom tradition, and the ability to respect freedom from religion, which, if we look at data on the nuns in the United States and globally, is emerging as a new flashpoint. That I feel we also have to recognize that in many of the countries that we speak to, there are non-believers, there are heretics, there are dissenters, and a good, coherent American foreign policy would recognize the importance of respecting their conscience as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Our next question comes from Doug Hosetter with the Mennonites.
For this very stimulating presentation, I wanted to call to your attention, and I especially appreciated the fact that you pointed out that it was religious people that pushed primarily for separation of church and state within the United States, which you're defining as secular. I think most of the Mennonites and many of the Quakers that pushed very hard for the separation of church and state probably would not have identified with that term, but I understand how you're using it politically. But especially like in Rhode Island and in Pennsylvania, the Quakers were very, very instrumental in separating church from state and respecting all religions and refusing to allow religion to dominate the state. And with the Mennonites, we started in the 16th century, and one of our primary defining characteristics was an absolute commitment to the separation of church and state and the primacy of following the will of God rather than the dictates of the state. So many Mennonites fled from Germany when the state churches there would not tolerate us and refused to allow us not to participate in the religious wars. And then Netherlands, the same thing, and my ancestors actually came to the United States seeking freedom of religion and basically seeking the freedom to be able to practice your faith without the state interfering with it. So thank you very much for your comments on that.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hosetter. Let me just nuance that a little bit. I agree with everything you've said. My studies are leading me to an interesting sidebar in all of this. You said something very interesting. You said, I don't know if we would have called it separation of state, and I've wondered about that myself, and I think you're correct. I think separation of church and state is a very strong term. It's very, very loaded. In a Jeffersonian tincture, it involves a wall, and a wall is impermeable. As I understand the classic Protestant tradition, which is an heir of a pre-modern tradition. I mentioned Marsilius of Padua and William of Ockham. The classic Christian polity had two parts to it, right? It had a spiritual arm and a temporal arm. And God sanctified the temporal arm as much as he sanctified the spiritual arm. And each wing had its proper task in a proper Christian polity. So the term separation of church and state is a little strong, right? Because there's no sense of degrading or eliminating the importance of the church in these early Christian understandings of what a proper Christian society would look like. So if you read my paper, which we've put online from the Oxford Handbook of Secularism, you'll see me develop this insight using the scholarship of many others. And I think you're right, separation of church and state might not quite get it, but the idea of two discrete units of activity, both sanctified and blessed by God, I do think is part of most Protestant thinking about this question.
Yeah, actually, the term separation of church and state feels very comfortable, I think, to most Mennonites. The term that they would have felt much less comfortable with would have been describing themselves as secularists.
Right, right. And we can talk about why that happened and when that happened if others are interested in knowing when that occurred. Absolutely.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Deva Kimmis with the Center of Concern.
Hi. Well, thanks so much for this discussion. It's been terrific so far. And I wondered if you might be able to comment a little bit further. You mentioned the category of gender as one way of approaching the secular in terms of policies, our foreign policy with other countries. And my interest is in, I work for the Global Women's Project here at the Center of Concern, and my interest today is in sort of when religious freedom and the rights of women, it could be the rights of anyone really, but particularly women in this case, collide, you know, how can we kind of approach that in terms of foreign policy? And I know you mentioned no coercion. And there are just numerous cases, both in the countries that you're speaking about today and in other countries as well. There was a horrific case in India that probably many of the people on the call heard about, and I don't want to sort of get into incendiary remarks, but where sort of de facto tribal councils will sentence very often women to crimes, and so for religious reasons, or ostensibly religious reasons. And in terms of foreign policy and kind of the question of the secular, I just wondered if you might speak a little bit to that collision between those two realms of each has a right on its own side, if that makes
yeah.
sense.
No, thank you, Ms. Kimmis, for the question. I would look at it this way. In terms of secularism, I think many secularists themselves believe that secularism was a type of panacea for everything that ailed women everywhere. That's a very 1950s, 1960s, 1970s sort of approach, that if we just had secular policies and we shunted religion out of the public square, then everything would go well for women. And as appealing as that worldview might be, I do think the reality on the ground is infinitely more complex. And now, I'm not a specialist in gender, but one thing that I keep encountering in my studies of gender and secularism is the following, and perhaps, Ms. Kimmis, you can make more sense out of this for our listenership. This is the problem, that often when you speak to religious women, women who are Muslims, women who are Jews, and you ask them if they want religion shunted to the side or moved out of their lives, or they want the intervention of a secular state, they often say no. And I've kept hitting that wall since graduate school, right? And I don't quite know how you get around it. What do you do when agents in good conscience, of good intelligence, right, want to live by the precepts of their religion, though they acknowledge that the religion needs a little bit of fixing? And, Ms. Kimmis, I don't know if this is a good enough answer to your question, because many of your concerns, I feel, are probably my concerns about women's rights. But what secularism often runs into is this lack of sensitivity to the fact that women on the ground who are religious love their religions, but they feel that something gender-wise within the religious tradition has gone wrong, and they don't see secular state policies as a savior or as a messiah, though many of us on the secular side, and I am a secularist, believe that things would go better for these women if they did. Is that helpful, Ms.
It's extremely helpful. Thank you. It makes a lot of sense, and perhaps it makes sense to think about it in terms of the, I don't remember how you put it exactly, but the call to conscience, or the value of conscience as one of the things that we need to look to when we're thinking about this, because, of course, you're right, many women religious are unwilling, and for good reason. I mean, in many cases, I'm thinking of the Catholic Church now, but there are examples all over the place. The Church actually helped women in many cases, so it's not quite as black and white as that. You're right. But I tend to agree with you that secularism would help protect women, particularly in these cases where justice, or what's called justice, is sort of meted out in the name of religion. So thank you again. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Black and white is not a color on the flag of secular studies. Just a quick addition, what the best thing I think secularists can do, whether they're religious or non-religious, is to encourage the fluidity of religious interpretation, is to empower Muslim women, to empower Jewish women to kind of enjoy all the possibilities that the vast Jewish halachic tradition presents, or that Muslim schools, Islamic schools of jurisprudence present to women. At that point, when you open up the systems of interpretation, this is an argument I made in a book called The Secular Bible, I feel that's the best thing that secular states can do, because religions, as we all know, are not these closed, monolithic systems. They're actually quite capacious and wide, and they offer many, many possibilities if believers are allowed to pursue those possibilities within the frameworks that they provide. Thank you, Ms. Kemmes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question or comment?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Richard Fulton, the American Jewish Committee.
Hi, Jacques. Thanks very much for a very interesting presentation. I'd like to turn to much of your presentation has been focused along, and I'm oversimplifying here, but has been focused on the legitimate and very palpable concern about the imposition of religious observance by one group on others who don't want to be subject to that observance. At the same time, I think perhaps not enough has been said about another problem, which is the problem of the religiously observant for whom secular values are being imposed on them to such a point that they are no longer able to act in consonance with their observance. You made a comment about how the two key principles are no coercion with respect to religious belief and also the sovereignty of conscience, and then as a footnote, you said, but of course what they do is another matter. Well, for some faiths, of course, what they do is such as Judaism, is crucial to practice, and we see in Europe, perhaps more so than here, but it's a problem here as well, efforts, for instance, to prohibit circumcision, to interfere with kosher slaughter, to do other things that would interfere with what Jews would see as intrinsic to their freedom of conscience. So the question I have for you is, within the concept of secularism, what can ought to be done to avoid what I would call the imposition of a secularist state, that is, one that imposes a secular view of society on people that have other views, at the same time as we have what is essential, which is a secular state in which people of diverse faiths may function in that society?
It's a wonderful question, and it's alongside gender, the question that you raise is the most difficult thing for secular theorists to work through. So let me take everyone back a little bit. Mr. Fulton made a really crucial observation about how separating beliefs from acts is not something that Jews can do necessarily with ease, nor is it something I feel that Catholics can do necessarily with ease. For some reason, within Protestant theology, and secularism is profoundly Protestant, the architects in modernity are Martin Luther, Roger Williams, John Locke, Jefferson, Madison. They all share something in common. They're men, obviously, and they're Protestants, or lapsed Protestants, if you want to think of our two presidents, right? What is interesting about Protestant theology is it does permit a sort of wall or a partition between what you believe and what you actually do. And what we find in many early secular states is they say this to all their citizens: you can believe anything you want. You're granted full freedom of conscience, but you are not granted full freedom to act. And the way secular states configured this theory was as follows: if your acts threaten public order, then they will not be permitted by the state, full stop. Who is the great theorist of that? That would be John Locke in The Letter Concerning Toleration. So the state can tolerate many things from the moment your activities are seditious or they lead to chaos or unrest. The state clamps down. So the problem is a very complex one, Mr. Fulton, right? What concerns me, and I am evading your question a little bit, and I expect the rest of you to kind of pile on me here, what concerns me is the idea that religious freedom is an absolute right, that it's a first freedom, that it trumps all other freedoms that we as Americans have. I don't think that's what the founders had in mind, and even if they did, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to argue that whatever it is that a religious community does, because they believe it, the secular state must tolerate those behaviors. So I've clearly not solved the problem of the question you've raised. What I'd like to do with you is just have everyone realize that this is where the action is in thinking about church-state relations, right? Where is the line where a state can intervene and tell a religious person of good conscience, you cannot do that, and we will use coercive force, because the state, of course, monopolizes the legitimate use of violence. We will use coercive force to make sure that you are not permitted to practice this aspect of your faith. And that's where the collisions occur. Mr. Fulton, back to you.
Well, I mean, what I want to say in response to that is that it's an oversimplification to say that what those who are arguing for accommodation want is an absolute out from any government regulation, which is in effect what you were saying just now.
Right.
But somewhere there's a balance that has to be drawn, and that balance does have to give respect to religious values. The value of religious observance is itself an intrinsically worthy value. If you look at the circumcision issue, you see many people who are perfectly willing to see a circumcision take place if it's medically indicated, but will at the same time say, if it's not medically indicated, it's a violation of the bodily integrity of the child. And in doing that, give no value to the ability of individuals and communities, I should say, which is even more important, to function in accordance with their beliefs, given that, nevertheless, we all understand that at some point, but it ought to be a point that gives due regard to religious faith, there are going to be observances that simply can't be respected and that can't be accommodated.
For me, and I clearly have a dog in this fight, circumcision is absolutely something that a state should permit, and I don't see the danger there, and I'm rather befuddled by attempts to banish circumcision. The more complex questions are religious practices that inconvenience others or endanger others. Let's take the example of aggressive forms of missionizing. We saw this, I believe, with the Jehovah's Witnesses around mid-century in the late 30s and the 40s. Forms of missionizing that can be extremely aggressive or can lead to unrest. So those are more the questions that concern me. The questions about kashrut and about circumcision, I would fully agree with you. Unless the state can come up with a compelling reason for saying this is bad for the social body writ large, it endangers individuals, I feel that's not a place where the secular state should go. Unfortunately, it's never that clear in my mind vis-a-vis other issues where religious groups engage in behaviors that I do think are either unfair or inimical to the health of their own community, their own children, their own women, et cetera, et cetera.
I guess I'm still on line, I just want to say I think you used the key word there, which is the word compelling, which suggests that there is a balancing test that has to take place. And I think that's what a secular society ought to strive for, is a balancing test that means that compelling interests can be enforced, but not merely those, for instance, reasonable or that could be justified, but that would run afoul of religious observance.
My preference is for secular states that grant the maximal degree of religious freedom, total religious freedom in belief, and maximal degree in religious freedom for acts. And if they're going to prohibit certain acts, there better be a clear, well-articulated, and equally applied standard.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Greg Hamilton with the Northwest Religious Liberty Association.
Yeah, hi, Doctor. Thanks. This is a fantastic discussion. Really appreciate it. My question may be a bit vague, but I'll give it a shot. American civil religion has always been something very special to me. How does American civil religion apply to your definition of secularism, and specifically the shaping of American foreign policy, let's say, in the last couple decades?
Can I just ask you for a little clarification? Do you mean in the sense that Robert Bella spoke about civil religion, this sort of vague, abstract notion that we're under God? Is that what you mean by civil religion?
Correct, because the way I understood the Pledge of Allegiance under God, at least the way Eisenhower applied it, it was almost strategic, the way I've understood it, in regard to the Cold War, and more symbolic than anything else. And I'm just curious how you apply all that to your definition of secularism and U.S. foreign policy today.
Great. I feel that civil religion had a lot to recommend it as an idea. The problem with American civil religion is it tended to infuriate smaller groups, and the smaller groups grew to become larger groups. And one group that we're seeing in particular that finds the idea that in public we acknowledge God and we do so in very ecumenical and vague terms so as to leave, in quotes, no one out, well, it is to the credit of the growing, burgeoning American atheist community that they've argued that they feel left out. There are also certain polytheistic traditions who could argue, well, when you say God, you kind of slice away 99% of the divinities that we might believe in. So this is a tremendous, tremendous problem, that the old school rules of an American civil religion, which really worked well in the era of Eisenhower, and I believe the Pledge of Allegiance is brought into play in 1954, 1955, and John F. Kennedy, his famous speech in September of 1960 in front of the Houston Ministerial Baptist Association, it really worked well then, the idea of civil religion, which is a good idea. The problem is now there are many who legitimately are contesting that, and they're arguing that the premise that we are under God, and this is a very big and vague God, is inimically hostile to their worldview, and it imposes certain ways of thinking, let's say, on their children who are forced to recite the pledge. Do I think tactically that's something that American non-believers should engage in? I've been very clear, no. I think sometimes you've got to let little things go. Nevertheless, as a theoretical principle, it is problematic, right, that we do acknowledge this God who seems very Abrahamic in public space, and there are many Americans that feel that this excludes them or denigrates their own belief systems.
Don't you see that still very much alive, both with the Christian right and also with the last administration, Bush and Cheney? They sort of reached the zenith of that that ethos, so to speak, that emphasis. Do you see that, or is that, am I off base there?
Well, I find that a lot of evangelicals aren't too enamored of the civil religion God either, right? Because to them, it's just a vague, watered-down abstraction, and it doesn't speak to something that they believe very profoundly in their hearts. So, unfortunately, civil religion as a unifying idea, I think its time may have passed, because there are very, very few people who endorse the idea of speaking about God in that particularly vague way in public. I'm one of those people, by the way. I've always liked the civil religion tradition. I suspect you have as well. But it yeah, lacks a constituency and a demographic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Constance Freeman with the Syracuse University.
First, let me say how much I've enjoyed this back and forth in conversation. In the discussion with the previous question, but one, we talked about things that were done in the name of religion, and I'm wondering about things that are done by missionaries from what is essentially a secular state, the U.S. I know there are questions on that, but we're more secular than not. In other countries, such as the evangelical campaign against gay people in Uganda, and how a government and a foreign service should be reacting to that because it's caused a great deal of harm.
Right. All right. So this is, thank you, Professor Freeman, for the question. This is very, very complicated. Let me go back to something I once heard from somebody at the State Department who told me that there are certain regions of the world where we have very, very little knowledge about what's going on the ground, and the people you go to for information are often evangelical or Mormon missionaries because they're there. Now, I'm not saying that in any particular way. I was stunned by learning that the State Department often relies on Americans who are engaged in missionizing in far-flung places, and I say that, of course, with a little smile, because they have lots of kind of local knowledge about how things work there. So that's an interesting thing to think about, though it's neither here nor there. So Professor Freeman's concern is definitely valid, I would flip it a little bit, and I would say, but on these issues, we often find that evangelicals have a wonderful record on issues that liberals are themselves quite concerned of, and that would be the question of human sexual trafficking, where evangelicals have done some fantastic work in the field. They've done some fantastic work in the field on the question of curing AIDS. But now let's get back to the problem about these, what I find to be really, really unhelpful and really regressive views on our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. How does the state deal with that? I guess the state can take one of two approaches. That is the American State Department. It can say, we know that there are Americans in the field in Uganda, and they are promulgating these ideas about gay persons, and we as a state have to officially and explicitly distance ourselves from those views. That's one way of doing it, and personally, speaking personally, that's what I would prefer would happen. A clear and unambiguous statement from the government saying, we do not support that worldview. That is not part of an American way of thinking about our citizens, many of whom are gay. The second is a kind of don't ask, don't tell, that you let these groups do what their conscience leads them to do in the field, and to be very clear that if they do so, they can receive no material support from the American government. And Professor Freeman, now I think I understand your question. Is your concern that these groups are often receiving funding from the American government to carry out what is often their good works? Am I to understand you that maybe that funding should be questioned or revoked?
I am concerned about that funding, but I am also concerned about the outright harm that is being done against our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters at the behest of the preaching of these missionaries, which is in direct contradiction with the humanitarian aid that we provide in that part of the world.
Right, right. I guess it's a legal question of what American citizens are allowed to do on soil that is not American soil. If I were to say to you, or if we were to confirm that they were receiving no government funding whatsoever, would that change the fulcrum of your question? Would it just be something that morally upset you as opposed to politically upsetting you if the American government were to completely detach itself from these groups?
I think that the American government needs to make sure, first and foremost, and I, for acknowledgement, I'm a retired Foreign Service officer, needs to make sure that we are in no way, shape, or form funding this exercise, and needs to look further at the degree to which the acts that are being undertaken in the name of religion are criminal or not. And if they are actually criminal acts, to go further in both disavowing them and trying to get these people sent home.
Fair enough, fair enough.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Peter Vandermeulen with the Christian Reformed Church of North America.
Thank you very much. I would like to go to just a really simple question that revolves around the difference, if there is one, between pluralism and secularism. Your definition of secularism, if I heard it correctly, sounded a great deal like a definition of pluralism. Could you talk a little bit about the differences between the two isms, if there is any?
I'm starting to notice that pluralism is almost becoming the it-ism of the moment, and it's being recognized as maybe that value that is ensconced within the secular worldview, that is a better way of packaging the product. So I'm going to say there's a tremendous amount of affinity between a pluralistic worldview and a secular worldview, though there are some contradictions. I'd imagine a pluralistic government, if the American government were committed to pluralism, then it would have to accommodate all religious groups equally, all right, and that is known as accommodationism. So it would have to fund all religious groups, it would have to equally honor their rights, it would have to equally offer them goods and services from the government. There are some forms of secularism that are at peace with that approach. though there are more stringent forms of secularism that aren't. So what I'm saying is, if you could think of pluralism and secularism as two circles, they clearly overlap, Mr. van der Meulen, right? Though there are forms of secularism that, for often good reasons, reject the basic premises of pluralism. And I know that might sound very, very harsh, so you'll ask, like what? Well, French laïcité, right? Where, for good historical reasons, and I often feel people will throw tomatoes at my head, you realize that my name is Jacques, and I have a French gene in the body, but I think for profound historical reasons, for the French, anyhow, they made a very clear decision based on hundreds and hundreds of years of conflict and violence and bloodshed to push religion out of the public sphere, thereby removing that avenue of pluralistic approach to citizens. Right? That works for the French, and I've always felt that we as Americans have to respect the French system because it has its own unique historical moorings. It comes from its own place, right? So a quick answer to your question would be, there are forms of secularism. We refer to these as accommodationism, for example. It was the idea of Nehru. To give you an instance, Nehru of India is on record, I'm paraphrasing, of saying a secular state is a state that accommodates all the religions in our state equally. That is a pluralistic form of secularism. So we have to be cautious that they're non-pluralistic forms of secularism, such as we find in France, and they have a legitimacy as well. So I don't want to just negate the legitimacy of the non-pluralistic forms.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tyler Wiggs Stevenson with the University of Toronto.
Hi. Thanks very much for this conversation. I'm going to make this question brief. I've got an infant in arms, so that should explain any unusual noises coming here. I had two related questions, which you could take either or both as it seems useful to you. You mentioned at the outset of the conversation that you went through many fits and false starts in coming up with a definition of secularism over the course of 10 to 12 years. And I'm curious if you wouldn't mind sort of tracing your thoughts for us through the major trajectories that led you to this binary of state power and religion. And then second, and related to that, as opposed as regards foreign policy, I wonder how your work would interact with that of scholars like, say, Saba Mahmood or Talal Asad, who would talk about an implicit subject, secular subject, that is oftentimes uncritically or without comment advanced by the secular state power. And now I'm going to put myself back on mute.
Thank you. Those are great questions for an academic, so I'm going to go through them very, very quickly. Question one, my misfires were evident in the 2005 Cambridge volume, The Secular Bible, Why Nonbelievers Must Take Religion Seriously, where I understood secularism then to be a kind of questioning nonbelief or questioning belief. And I hadn't put my sociology hat back on. I was thinking way too much as a biblical exegete. And my definition of secularism in 2005 was that it was a form of omnidirectional criticism that you blasted at everyone. And then I moved to Washington, and I realized the sort of paucity, or excuse me, the poverty of using those types of tools to deal with secularism. So that was clearly a misfire, though I do think it's a pretty neat book. On the second question, well, don't get me started. My opinions of the postmodern, post-Foucauldian, post-colonial schools are rather well known. I refer to that as Pomofoco. And I am, shall we say, not an ally. Let me, to not alienate 99% of the folks on this phone call, let me tell you what my problem is with these postmodern approaches to secularism. Epistemologically, postmodernism is wild. I love it. If Marx once spoke of a ruthless critique of everything existed, that was the Marxist program, and when I was 18 years old, I loved that sort of thing. I feel postmodernism is one of the great conceptual vehicles to be really, really critical of everything in the world. And that's what we like to do in universities, at least under the laboratory conditions of a classroom with our students. The problem with the approaches with the scholars you've mentioned, and I actually studied with Talal Asad when I was at the New School, what I find really, really problematic there is, even though the epistemology is very, very critical, it's almost impossible to find a postmodern, postcolonial, post-Foucauldian analysis of secularism that doesn't slam secularism as some type of ruse of the liberal, heterosexist, patriarchal Enlightenment nation-state. So there's no corresponding criticism of religious forms of power. There's a soft spot for Islamism that I find in way too much postmodern, post-Foucauldian, and post-colonial critique, and I don't understand it. So what I'm saying is, when we look at these schools of thought, and I'm sorry if I'm boring people, the epistemology of postmodernism, I think, is bigger than the conclusions that academic postmodernists are coming to vis-a-vis secularism and religion. For some reason, there is this reluctance to really think hard about these traditionalist forms of religion, which I believe are often extremely problematic, and something that I wish these theorists would look at a little bit more carefully.
Thank you. I think we have time for one last question.
Our next question comes from Robert Leakin with the American Jewish Committee.
I've been enjoying this immensely. Thank you very much. An earlier caller, I think at the beginning of the conversation, talked about finding ways to show regard, and you were talking about this a little bit now, but just societies that are hostile to secularism and separation of church and state, and recognize that, you know, our norms may not be the same as theirs, and we need to find a way to have a conversation. Subsequently, in a number of occasions, you've talked about that, I think you used the word bedrock, is freedom of conscience and freedom from religion are the bedrock principles we should work from. Given that, and given the fact that we have many societies for whom separation of church and state is simply not part of their norms and languages, or some societies or movements that are promoting that idea. Is there, in fact, I mean, people, we're all reluctant to say this, but are we operating in an environment where there is a genuine debate about the nature of the good that we ought to recognize and in a clear sense, or is that the case for that, the conflict of civilizations type of concept overstated?
Okay, so a very, very interesting query. Let's just start by reiterating something. Separation of church and state is not the be-all and end-all of human social existence, as you clearly recognize. Here are some empires that have had clear separation of church and state. The Soviet Union, and I don't think anybody would want to be a citizen of that entity. And here are some nations that have no separation of church and state, at least not constitutionally. That would be Anglican Britain and Finland. Finland has not one, but two religions. So I think what we have to do as secularists is to disabuse ourselves of the notion, and you certainly didn't have this notion, that only when we achieve pure separation of church and state will we somehow achieve some version of the good. The second part of your question is the one that I think is a little bit above my pay grade, and this is where we get more to the philosophical debates about what is the ultimate good for a social body. And here is where I find postmodernism to be very, very useful, in that it reminds us that no matter what a social body might think is the ultimate good, within that very social body, there will be people that don't agree. And I guess that's the kind of classic tragedy of human social existence, or maybe the classic euphoria of living with others, is recognizing that no social body can ever completely agree on what would constitute the good society. All right, and this is why I feel secular states have such a useful role to play, strangely enough, because what they tend to do is they tend to look at all these competing conceptions of the good and try to regulate, arbitrate, negotiate between them. Those are the secular states, of course, that work, and I would be the first to acknowledge that many secular states have failed abysmally. But the ideal secularism will be one that can take these competing conceptions of the good and find a way to maximize every citizen's ability to live according to their conception of the good under a situation of order and peace and tranquility. Last thought, one of the most interesting things I learned about secularism reading Marsilius of Padua and William of Ockham and Luther was the tremendous emphasis they placed on peace. peace. Why was it so important to curtail religious power, naked, untrammeled, unchecked religious power, so that there could be peace, so that everyone could get to God? And that is one of the originating insights or impulses of secularism as we know it today.
I am sorry to say that we are out of time, but Jacques, thank you very much for sharing your valuable insights, and to all of you for your great comments and questions. I think we had a fruitful discussion, and obviously there's a lot of interest in this topic. Again, we had many people still on the call wanting to ask questions. So thank you, Jacques.
Thank you so much.
And as all of you know, this conference call series is part of CFR's Religion and Foreign Policy Initiative, seeking to connect religious and congregational leaders and scholars in cross-denominational conversations on a broad range of pressing international issues. We appreciate your feedback and suggestions, so please email us at outreach@cfr.org, and we look forward to hearing from you. And our next conference call will address the peace talks on Syria that began in Switzerland earlier this week. And it will be next Tuesday, January 28th at 11 o'clock a.m. A formal invitation will follow under separate cover. So thank you again to Jacques Berlinblauer and to all of you.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.